Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. My name is Jonathan Wilson and I'm your host. In today's episode, I'm going to take you to a wild, rugged corner of the world where there are, even today, still tribes in remote jungles who've had little or no contact with the outside world. I'm going to take you back in time. It's 2011. I'm in a remote village in the high central mountains of Papua. I'm in the Yali tribe. And there's an incredible scene unfolding before me. Villagers from across various valleys are descending on this central location. They're arriving in their thousands. I'm watching as long, winding columns enter the village of Ninia, coming from the north, coming from the south, coming from the east and the west. And in each of these columns, there's hundreds and hundreds of people singing and chanting in the powerful, pumping, energetic way that the Yali do. And the style of singing that they're using comes from their warrior days, when songs like this were for going into battle. And for days, the Yali gather to celebrate a transformation that the whole tribe has experienced. That's why they've come together. And they speak constantly about it as, "We were rescued from darkness and brought into light." And their songs are not, in fact, about war. They're about Jesus. For in 2011, the Yali, as I said, in their thousands, were celebrating 50 years since the good news of Jesus had been brought to them by missionaries from a completely different part of the world. The Yali had experienced what we're calling in this podcast, big change. And to them, it was worth what they called a jubilee, a 50-year anniversary, basically a massive party with feasting and speeches and a lot of dancing. Now, I grew up among the Yali, and when I was a year old, my parents went to live and work among them as missionaries. We became one with the Yali in many ways. In fact, my dad was buried there recently. And when I was 17, I ended up returning to the UK where my parents were originally from. I went to university there. And then after that, my life and career took me first to Canada, then to South Africa, then back to Canada, and now back to South Africa again. And in between, I've returned many times to Papua and to the Yali. They really are my home, my heart's home. But South Africa is my other love. And as we will hear in a coming episode, South Africa has had a very different experience of Christianity to what the Yali experienced, and a different journey of change. But I believe the Papuan story and the South African story has each have something to offer to the other. And so I've asked my South African friend Simon Lerefolo to be my conversation partner today as I share more of the experience of the Yali and the good news that, as they see it, rescued them from darkness. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you, Jonathan.
It's great to have you. Let me share a bit of Simon's background. So Simon was born and raised in Potchefstroom, which is in the northern part of South Africa. Simon studied mechanical engineering at WITS and has also done courses in economics, peace building, and conflict transformation. And now, Simon, you're doing your master's in theology.
Correct.
Now, Simon and I have known each other since around 2001, when he came along and participated in the Ascent Leadership Training Program that my team and I at African Enterprise used to run in those days. At that time, Simon, you'd just finished working as project engineer at Unilever and had taken on work as a consultant at Opus Dei Advisory Services, a project management and strategy consulting company. Before I carry on with your bio, tell me a little bit about what coming to the Ascent program meant for you back then when we met.
Yeah, the Ascent program really helped epitomize to me the importance of nation building. Preferred to actually call it nation building. Even then, it was about a leadership development. It was about how to help leaders become who God has called them to be in all different spheres of life. So when I found out about Ascent and the possibility of partnering with you guys in raising future leaders of South Africa, I was ready to go.
It was definitely a meeting of hearts when we met back then. So since then, you've become a pastor, moving out of the corporate world. And so Simon has been part of Every Nation Rose Bank for some 30 years now, the last seven as lead pastor, along with his wife, Lindy. Simon and Lindy are very passionate about healthy marriages, nation building, and discipleship, and they have three children, Lemo, Zinzi, and Rory.
That is correct.
Yeah. So glad you could join me, Simon.
First, I must say it was a big honor when I was invited to be part of this journey of the big change. I really believe that is so vital to where our nation is, South Africa. We are recording this just on coming out of the elections, the national elections that have been highly contested. For me, the big change is the part that each individual can play in bringing change to South Africa and wherever God may have placed them to be.
Before we start, I have one shout out to make. So we talked about big change and the Yali. Other changes have also reached the Yali and reshaped their lives, including the technological developments of recent years. I have a brother who's in conservation, and he's actually among the Yali right now. And he posted something on Facebook today, and he's in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
So that tells you about some of the technological changes that are coming there. So it's very possible that some of my Yali friends are listening to this podcast. And so it's only right that I greet my brothers and sisters there.
Norin erekwi, an Yesu sunukfam dang henrepukari. Yahayo an o Afrika salatam welri famen annenda o et mawarek.
That's impressive, Jonathan. Wow.
Yeah, it's a language that has stayed with me. I'm not as fluent as I used to be. Whenever I go back, it starts to, you know.
It comes back.
Yeah, it comes back. The gears get greased. So, Simon, let's start into hearing about the experience of the Yali in encountering the good news of Jesus. But to tell that story well, we have to have a bit of context for who they are and where they live and what their lives are like when that happened. So to give some context, the Yali live on the island of New Guinea, which is the second largest island in the world. On that island, there are approximately 1,000 tribes, and 1,000 tribes that speak 1,000 very different languages. So where I grew up among the Yali, which was extremely remote and isolated, the tribe to the east, the linguistic differences were as great as probably between, say, English and something like Iranian. And that's just two or three valleys to the east. To the north, it was more like English to French. And to the south, again, it was very different. This mutual unintelligibility or very limited connection between languages was a reflection of how these tribes had developed in isolation from each other over centuries and perhaps millennia. And so the Yali were, in a sense, from the world's perspective, a forgotten people. You know, they were unknown. And as people did come to encounter people like the Yali in the 50s and the 60s, as New Guinea opened up to the outside world, they were really seen as an exotic novelty. They were probably regarded by most people somewhat condescendingly. You know, these people locked away, living Stone Age existences. And they were an anthropological curiosity. They are a strong communal culture. There's a lot of richness to who they are. They have strong oral traditions. My dad often used to say it's wrong to call people like the Yali illiterate. They're not illiterate. They might not be able to read. They are oral. And that's a skill of its own. It's a skill that we don't have as much in Western culture. But there was also a lot of brokenness and deep toxicity in the Yali culture. They practiced a constant revenge warfare. And this was taking place right up until when I was a little boy in the first years that we lived there. They would practice cannibalism on their victims. And unlike is commonly thought about tribes like this, they're not practicing cannibalism for some mystical reason per se. Although sometimes there was a bit of that going on, their main thing that they were doing was to commit the worst possible offense or insult to their enemies, to the point where, for example, again, because these are very high mountains, very steep-sided, sometimes villages were actually in sight of each other, villages that were at war with each other. And so when someone was killed from one village and they would obtain the body, I should say the enemies would remove the body that they killed. They would take it back to their own village. They would dismember the body and they would wave the limbs so that their enemies on the other side could see.
Wow.
That they were mocking and dishonoring, you know, the body of their enemy's loved one. And they would call insults across the valley, you know, shout them across. I have friends that I grew up with that their fathers were warriors. They were war leaders. And I've heard many stories told with great delight about how they deceived or, you know, somehow exploited the enemy in some clever trickery or ambush that resulted not just in killing them, but in the worst possible kinds of insult. So this was a key dimension of Yali life, and it just went back and forth, because if my enemies have killed my loved one or my relative, then there's now a deceased ancestor who's still in the spiritual realm who can negatively influence things if I don't avenge their death. And so it would just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
So Jonathan, just for clarity, so when you and your family arrived there, these stories are still fresh in the minds of these people, and some of these practices were still there.
They were still happening.
Wow.
So when I was maybe 2 or 3 years old, our village was actually attacked one day, and I don't remember it, but my mom tells me the story of these Yali warriors calling out their death wail in the forest above our village and then descending through the forest. And she saw them coming out of the forest to attack our village. And I apparently wanted to go and watch.
Wow.
She wouldn't let me out of the house. And, you know, typical mom being too controlling, you know.
But this says a lot about your parents and your family having to go to a place like that to bring the gospel and the good news. Yeah. I'm really blown away.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we'll say more on that in a moment, because it gives lie to this idea that missionaries are going in with some sort of agenda to exploit or to impose something. Missionaries who are really doing the work seriously, they're often in quite vulnerable positions. And you don't do that unless you really care about the people you're there for. So yeah, that was going on. I mean, I had more than one friend who had basically been brought along to watch battles. So guys my age or a bit older than me that I grew up with and played with had been exposed to watching a battle unfold so they could learn. I had older friends than me who had to carry the bodies of victims back to their villages. Mm. Yeah, and this stuff is real. Then there was also the experience of women in Yali culture. Women were seen very much as somewhere along the same level of your livestock. They were there to bring your children into the world, to cultivate your crops, to work the gardens, to prepare your food. Each married woman had her own hut, and then the men lived in a communal hut. And that, in some ways, was a positive, that later on, as things started to change, that became quite a healthy dynamic, because each woman has her own piece of property, in a sense. So that was a curious anomaly in a way. But women were terribly, terribly treated. And the estimate is, when I was a boy, is that probably around 10% of women would commit suicide.
Wow.
And as a boy, I can remember several times where all of a sudden the village would go crazy. There'd be hollering and shouting and whooping. And you would see men rushing out to the village, and you'd realize they were trying to catch up with a woman who was running down the mountainside to throw herself into the rapids of a nearby river, and because that would have instantly killed her. And so they were doing their best to stop her from doing that. So these are things that, as a kid, I saw. They were happening.
10% is a lot. Sure. I mean, to think that women were treated that way then and that it's still happening today, it is actually very sad.
No, I would say it's one of the key manifestations of sin in our world.
That is very true.
Yeah, the abuse and the mistreatment of women. And so that was the lot of women. And just to add a bit of color there, I can remember as a boy, if I was with other men and we were walking along a trail, for example, and there was a woman on the trail because she was coming from or going to her gardens, she would turn her back out of respect. It was the right thing to do, that we not have to encounter her face to face.
Wow. Yeah. That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Just anecdotally, there's still some of those cultural practices in African culture,
right,
especially in very, very rural African culture, yeah, the way men are respected. And when the man comes walking, the woman stops.
Right.
It should be the other way around.
Right. Yes. To give away a bit of where the story's going, all of that has radically changed, but we'll come to that.
Good.
Yeah. So then just more generally, I think, you know, sometimes there's these myths about the noble savage, you know, the tribe in a remote jungle living in harmony, blissful harmony with this stunning rainforest environment. It is a stunning environment, and there are many ways that the Yali people are highly skilled in that environment. But it's also a very threatening environment, malaria, tropical disease. And if a Yali, you know, cut themselves working in the forest and then tried to treat that infection. Sometimes the poultices or the treatments they used would just make things worse. Then you'd get an infection in a tropical climate that's deadly. And so life expectancy amongst the Yali was quite low. You know, men and women typically were dying in their 50s. To be old was to be in the 60s. So again, these things have subsequently changed. So this is the world to which missionaries came. In Papua, in general, around the 1950s, there was this increased interest in the Western world in Christian churches in the UK, the US, and so on, as to who these people were. And had they heard the good news of Jesus? Well, obviously not. And so many men and women made the effort to go and live among them. The Yali were first seen from the air by missionaries flying in a small plane over the mountains of Papua. So two missionaries, Stan Dale, who was an Australian, and Bruno De Leo, who's a Canadian, trekked into the Yali, having identified where they were, trekked over high, high mountains over about 4,000, 5,000 meters of altitude, and down into their valleys, and made first contact in 1961. It was an incredible story. So what was going on is the day that they arrive, they don't realize this is going on, but one of these conflicts is about to erupt. So villagers from one side of a valley, the valley that they're walking into, are about to go into battle with villagers from the other side of the valley. Now, there was an open kind of an area by a river between these two villages, and that's where these two war parties were about to meet when all of a sudden these two Caucasian males, but also with Christians who were from another tribe that had already experienced the gospel, they're coming in with Stan and Bruno, a bunch of men from the Dani. And as they walk in, of course, this battle just doesn't start. Mm. They're literally about to come together. And Stan and Bruno don't realize that this has been happening. They just see two groups of men all armed. So they start to use the Dani language, which was the neighboring language, to try and communicate, make greetings, and ask for food, including pig. Mm. Now, and pig is the kind of, it's like cows in South Africa. Like it is.
It's a big thing.
It's a big thing, yeah. And so they're asking for pigs. Now, the Dani language and the Yali language are sufficiently related that certain words have crossed over, including the word pig. In fact, that's the only word that was heard.
See where this is going.
And what the Yali, they were so shocked. They'd never seen humans like this. They'd never seen clothing. Their intuitive thought was that this might be ancestors coming back from the dead. When someone dies among the Yali, they cremate them. And of course, then you have ashes, and ashes are white.
Correct.
So they thought maybe these are ancestors returned from the dead. And they actually tried to correlate whether one was a certain guy that they knew who had died a few years ago and another was another man.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And then they hear them asking for pigs, and they thought our ancestors are asking us to make peace with each other across these two villages.
Wow.
So they did. Now, Stan and Bruno had no idea that this was happening until later, once they understood the culture and the language. Now, what's so interesting about that is in that particular part of the Yali, so that's what they call the northern Heluk of the Yali, that peace, which happened by sheer accident and misunderstanding, it lasted permanently. It never went away, because by the time the gospel really started to take root, there was no need to go back to war.
That is incredible, Jonathan. And that's exactly how the story started. Stan and Bruno ended up there, and they ended up becoming peace brokers without realizing it,
by sheer accident.
Wow.
So, you know, then they start to settle, and they make small little homes, just very rustic homes, and they lived among the Yali. Stan eventually brought his family in. Bruno was single at the time. Learned the Yali language. People started to come to faith, especially young men. And I know some of these guys. And when you hear what they were thinking, they were basically thinking our system of living in fear of the ancestral spirits, which was the dominant religious kind of worldview that they had, it simply led to more misery, more violence, more suffering, whether it was the violence of war or whether it was the suffering brought about by the things you had to do to appease the spirits. And here was a message of good news that was life-giving, you know, where there was a God of love offering his forgiveness, but also offering inclusion into himself and his family. and redemption from evil, you know, and they know that what they experience from this spiritual realm is evil, and that what results from their religious beliefs and how that plays out in revenge warfare is evil. Nevertheless, as people are becoming Christians, it creates a strong reaction amongst the powerful in the Yali, religious leaders like Shaman, and also, you know, other war leaders, chiefs, and so on. And so what ends up happening is in 1965, two Yali men, Yekwaraho and Bingwok, who had been brought to faith in Jesus through the work of Stan and Bruno, they are so excited about this message. They go down to the southern part of the Yali, which is where I ended up growing up. And within a day of starting to preach, they're dead.
They were killed. No way.
Yeah, they were killed and they were cannibalized. So Stan hears about this. The news comes up the valley, and he, of course, he's very upset. He's very distressed. These were like sons to him. And with a man who, well, he's a friend of mine, but was a very close friend of my dad's, a man called Luliap, and one or two others, Stan went down to that area. And within a day, he was attacked.
No way.
Yeah, and he was shot with 5 arrows in an ambush. Now, Stan was a former soldier from World War II. He's a tough guy. And he thought he was going to die that night. But through the night, he, with Luliap's help, made their way back up the valley, walking through rapids, climbing mountains, and he had been shot in his legs and in his abdomen. And these arrows, by the way, the Yali arrows, the heads of the arrows alone are about 30 to 40 centimeters long.
Wow.
Yeah, and they shoot them all the way through you or deep into you.
Wow.
And usually when they would attack their victims, they would try and shoot as many arrows as possible. So that's why Stan had 5 in him. So they eventually make it back to his home village. By then, there was an airstrip in the village, and he's flown out. He recovers after surgery in a more developed part of Papua, returns to the Yali 6 months later, and they're seriously gobsmacked. Why would someone come back to us that we just tried to kill? Why would somebody do that?
I can only imagine what went through their minds. We tried to kill this person, and this person comes back and continuing to do what he was doing before he left. And I'm also glad that you mentioned that they were using arrows, because when you said shooting, I was wondering
right. What
was happening there.
Yes, no AK-47s.
There you go.
So Stan comes back, continues to teach. And by the way, one of the other things that was also really annoying these leaders is that they're teaching women.
Oh,
and I remember Bruno actually saying that one day some men, guys who had become Christians, come to him and say, why are you also teaching our women? Because they're just stupid.
Mm.
And so Bruno just calmly says, you just wait and watch. And Bruno said what made him laugh, he didn't laugh outwardly, but laugh inwardly, is he said already some of the women that he'd been working with were far brighter than the men he'd been working with. So
I'm not surprised what was happening there at the time that they're experiencing this enlightenment, realizing what God has put in the woman too.
Yeah.
That's the news of the gospel.
Yeah. So then where this story ends with regards to Stan, and well, not so much Bruno, but with regards to Stan, is that 3 years later, 1968, Stan is joined by an American missionary simply to make a tour through another part of the Yali, the easternmost part of the Yali. He wasn't even there to try and preach. He was actually just more like doing a survey,
okay. Seeing
where the villages were, getting to know people. But that area of the Yali had been told, if Stan ever comes to you and to your area, you must take the opportunity to take him out because there's too many people here who support him. And that's what ended up happening. I'm going to jump ahead in time. I'm going to jump ahead to when I'm 21 years old. You know, I've lived in Papua. I've grown up there. The Yali that I know is radically different now. It's peaceful. And one day I meet a man called Ahul. Now, Ahul, as I get to know him, he's a Christian. He's the one who led the attack on Stan and his American colleague, Phil Masters.
Mm-hmm.
When Stan and Phil came through their area and they had 4 or 5 Yali and Dani Christians with them, Ahul called together some Yali one afternoon and he said, this is our opportunity. Stan and Phil and their Yali friends, they went down, they camped by the river. And during the night, Ahul sent messages to other villages and he pulled together a war party of about 200 warriors. The next day, these warriors followed Stan and Phil openly up the valley. Now, we don't know what Stan thought because we have no record of that or what Phil thought. Mm. But these warriors followed them openly and they were doing their chanting and their war dancing. And this lasted for hours. They followed them up valley as Stan was going to back towards his home village, which would have required about a full day's hiking
sure.
through really tricky terrain and big, you know, high mountains.
Is this the way of driving them out of their environment, basically? We don't want you here.
No, it's a way of basically taunting them until they're going to kill them.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just like, we'll load you up with as much fear as possible, and then we'll do it. And so Stan and Phil came, and their friends came to a river. It was a small river. You could wade through it. They crossed through it, and Ahul says now, and he crosses the river, and Stan turned to him and basically listed the Yali sins. In Yali culture, it's a sin to steal wives. It's a sin to steal pigs, these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. It's a sin to murder your own family. You can murder somebody from another village. That's different. And he basically calls out and says, we've come with love and we've come to serve you. We've not, and he lists the Yali sins. We've not stolen your wives, etc. And from Ahul's story, he told me this himself. He basically ran up to Stan. Stan's arms are up in a kind of peacemaking kind of posture. And he shot him straight under the arm through his ribs. And then he stood over him and kept shooting him and said, it's good to kill you.
Wow.
Yeah. And Phil was killed. The tribal folk with them got away. Two of them died in the mountains from hypothermia. One of them made it back to Ninia, the home village, and brought this tragic news. And you would have thought that would have been probably the death blow to the Christian faith. But ironically, it actually became the turning point. Hmm. Of the spread of Christianity among the Yali. It's hard to even explain. Like, you can't just say the deaths happened and then the Yali said X, Y, and Z, and now we understand logically why they were remorseful. Or there's no obvious reason why. There was, within a year or two of Stan and Phil's death, there was just this sudden turning. We need to know about this good news.
Wow. I'm still recovering from the fact that you met this person who shot Stan and the American missionary. For me, this is fascinating. Roughly how old is this guy by the time you meet him?
I'm guessing back then he would have already been in his 50s. So they arrive and things were still pretty tense when we first lived among the Yali. I was a year old. My dad is doing his best to learn the culture, learn the language. My mom's working in the clinic. And then in 1975, my dad himself is also threatened with his life. And he's written a book, a memoir called In Other Worlds. And his name is John Wilson, if anybody wants to look it up on Amazon. And he tells this story in the opening chapter of that book, where he's at a riverbank with Yali Christians and with Bruno. And on the other side of the riverbank, and this is in a canyon, there are perhaps 100 Yali warriors massed, threatening them, shooting arrows across, and also climbing the cliffs and rolling boulders down the cliffs that bounce across. Between all of that chaos and noise and the threats being shouted and the roar of the river itself, which was in full flood, my dad was terrified.
Sure.
And of course, fresh in his mind is the fact that just a few years earlier, Stan and Phil had been murdered by the Yali. And he's sitting on a rock and he prays, basically apologizes or asks for forgiveness from the Lord for his fear. And all of a sudden, audibly, God speaks to my dad in his head, and he says, John, there's going to be no more blood shed for my work among these people. I've given you a work to do, and you're going to live to see it completed. What my dad didn't know then was how good his linguistic skills were. And so what ended up happening is that he took on the translation of the Bible into the Yali language. And that was key in many levels. Firstly, just purely looking at a social and cultural level, it meant that their language got put into writing. And as a result of that, my dad with my mom developed a literacy program, which my mom rolled out. And then she trained Yali people to teach other people to read and to write. So the literacy, they were an oral culture, which my dad always admired, but they added to it this literary ability. And it got to a point where many, many Yali could read and write.
That's incredible.
Then they also had the Bible in their own language. And this is how the Yali would speak about it and understand it, is God has spoken to us in our language.
you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please share with your friends so that more people can discover how their faith can shape a better world.
Wow, Jonathan, that's actually very, very big. I'm realizing now that your parents basically were first-generation missionaries together with Bruno and Stan, and your dad was the first person to translate the Bible into their home language. Mm. So there were no schools the time you guys got there. That is fascinating.
So they published a New Testament in 1990. Big celebration. Again, you know, God has spoken to us in our own language. And then a few years later, the Old Testament was published. The key thing about this is that, and this is a reflection of how my dad worked. My dad really was deeply respectful of the local people and their capabilities. So he taught Yali men in particular to learn how to do Bible translation and to work with laptop computers.
Wow.
So they could get access to the various tools that modern translators use. So to do that, he had to first get a generator, then solar power was starting to become usable. And so he brought in solar capabilities so that they could power laptops. And the Old Testament was mostly translated by Yalis, not by my dad. And he just advised and watched. And for him, that was a delight. That was a thrill. And so it was the first complete Bible published in Papua. Up to that point, New Testaments had been translated, but not the whole Bible. And to this day, as far as I know, it was the only Bible where the majority of it was translated by the indigenous people.
That's incredible. So, Jonathan, we know we've heard of stories of David Livingston. You are still alive to tell the story of first-generation missionaries in Papua New Guinea. Would like to know, really, the impact of it in your life.
Well, the impact on me is that I watched transformation unfold. So I remember seeing warriors. I remember seeing shamans. The sense of darkness that was often there in villages. I remember the spiritual element of that too. The sense of like almost a demonic oppression that you would sometimes feel. And what I saw over the years was a radical transformation at every level of the culture. And we are going to explore that a bit more as we start to look at the text of Colossians. But before we get there, I want to highlight a few things that I think are very important for people to understand about the work of missionaries at its best, because there's obviously bad examples and unhealthy or toxic examples of missionary work from history. And by the way, if anybody wants to explore this particular question more of missionaries and their legacy, the rights and the wrongs, they should look up the podcast Unbelievable by Justin Brierley. And there's an episode in that podcast about missionaries and their legacy in which I participated, and listeners might want to go and hear that. What I think this story fleshes out is very key to who God is, how he works in history. And the first is, he's always looking for those who are on the margins. He's looking for those who aren't being loved, who aren't being reached, whether it's the poor in a city or whether it's a tribe in some forgotten part of the world that nobody really cares about.
Yeah.
But he cares about them. And then he infuses that love into some obscure Christian, you know, some ordinary Christian in Scotland, in the case of my dad, in England, in the case of my mom, brings them together and they find their way across half the planet and put themselves in this remote community and live vulnerably amongst a people like the Yali.
That's incredible. I mean, listening to the story, I'm thinking of the words of Jesus. You know, he will leave the 99 and go for the one.
So let me say one more thing about what I think that the work of the missionaries tells us about God and how he works with us in our world. And that is the importance of proximity, nearness. It's about relationship. Mm-hmm. As opposed to about just the passing of information. The love of God is lived out relationally. It contains information, contains truth. It contains things that enlighten us and change us. But it's lived in relationship. And as a result of that, it expresses itself culturally. And the love of God can be translated. It can go from one culture to another culture. And it doesn't mean that a Yali who becomes a Christian has to look like a Brit or a somebody from Poland who becomes a Christian. They're each going to look quite different, and yet the love of God, the love of Jesus is going to flesh out in their reality. So I think these are some key things to take away from the work of the missionaries.
So, Jonathan, thank you so much for that very, very important part of being a missionary. A big part of it is proximity, is coming to live with the people, is coming to understand the culture of the people. It's literally being incarnational, getting to know who they are, and not changing them to become something that they are not, but to actually be who God has called them to be through the gospel.
So yes, we've been working through the letter, or using the letter of Colossians as kind of the base for the series. And today we're going to go into chapter 2. Chapter 1 kind of shaped episode 1. We're going to look at chapter 2 today. And in a moment, we'll hear a reading. But just as a quick comment before this, I haven't mentioned this yet in our last two episodes, but I have theological training. I had that after I did my bachelor's degree. I went and I did a master's of divinity. And then, as you know, I have a dad who is a Bible translator. And the result of all of that is that I love to also read scripture carefully, and at times will do my own translation work. And so for this series, I've been doing my own translations to try and bring out as clearly as possible what the letter is saying for our listeners. In the text that we're about to read, most translations will use the word Christ, where I'm using the word Messiah. And I've done that deliberately because I want listeners to be completely clear as to what Christ actually refers to. The word Christ is referring to the Jewish idea of a Messiah who is the specially anointed individual to become king. So here's the reading.
As you have received Messiah, Jesus the Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving. Be careful not to allow anyone to captivate you through an empty, deceitful philosophy that is according to human traditions and the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Messiah. For in him, in the Messiah, all the fullness of deity lives in bodily form, and you Christians have been filled in him who is the head over every ruler and authority. In him you are also circumcised, not, however, with a circumcision performed by human hands, but by the stripping off of the fleshly body, in the circumcision of Messiah. Having been buried with him in baptism, you also have been raised with him through the faithfulness of the power of God, who raised Jesus from the dead. And even though you were dead in your wrongdoing and in the uncircumcision of your flesh, he nevertheless made you alive with him, with Jesus the Messiah, having forgiven all your wrongdoing. He, that is God, has destroyed what was against us, a certificate of indebtedness expressed in legal demands opposed to us. He has taken it away by nailing it to the cross, disarming the rulers and authorities. He made a public disgrace of them, triumphing over them by the cross. This reading was taken from Colossians 2, verses 8 to 15.
Now, the reason, Simon, that we've heard from this text is because this text beautifully encapsulates what the Yali experience of the good news. If you hear this text, it's actually summarizing in just a few verses multiple dimensions of what God has done for us through Jesus. It's a cosmic gospel. It's a cosmic good news. It's universe-wide and not only about one's personal inward self. And the Yali, that's what they heard when they heard the good news. They realized we are hearing a message that speaks to us in every dimension of this very hard world we live in, a world of war.
Yeah.
War that we know intrinsically or is really coming out of our own malevolence, our own violence and ill will. But it's also a world of where there's natural disasters. You know, there's just this big landslide in Papua New Guinea, which is the other side of the same island. Those kinds of things happened to the Yali people, you know, entire crops or villages getting wiped out in an earthquake or a landslide. So you have these horrendous things that can happen to you. There's the health issues I talked about earlier. There's the ancestral spirits. You never quite know, are they for you or against you? You've got to manage that. And other aspects of the spiritual realm, the demonic spirits. By the way, they didn't actually have a conception of a god, of an overarching spiritual deity. They only believed in the ancestral spirits and other types of demonic spirit. And here's a good news that is saying Jesus has conquered all of that. He's addressed all of that. But in order to do so, he's had to go to the heart of things, which is human sin. It's clear from this passage that our sin creates an indebtedness. I think sometimes we have an inadequate view of our sin, you know, and especially since most of us live what we think is relatively decent lives, and we don't realize how deeply self-centeredness permeates our behavior. And you only have to look at, say, the Germans before World War II, many of them suburban people living decent lives. But when the right conditions come into place, the right kind of leadership, the right kind of social dynamics, and all of a sudden those people are becoming people who participate in a Holocaust.
Sure.
But the Yali, they'd seen their own sin. They'd seen their own broken behavior. And yet they knew that something in all of that was wrong. I remember a friend who was older than me, younger than my dad, telling my dad that he had refused to eat human flesh when it was offered to him because something in him said, this can't be right. But he didn't know how to name that. He didn't know what to do with that, that instinct. So they encounter this good news that frees them from their own sin, and it's their own sin that makes them vulnerable to the dark powers. That's something that's clear in Colossians, and it's something that they experienced. So it's interesting. They experience God's forgiveness. They receive what he has to offer them. It cleans their slate, and it means the sin is no longer held against them, but it also means the dark powers no longer have power over them. Now, the village that I grew up in didn't used to exist. It's built on a plateau that prior to the gospel coming was seen as a no man's land. You don't go there because that's where the spirits live.
Wow.
And so only after the Yali became Christians did they feel comfortable to go and start creating a village on this land. And that's where I ended up growing up. And I once asked a friend of mine, I said, you know, when you moved into Holowan, this area, I said, was that because you were no longer believed in the evil spirits, or you were no longer afraid of them? Like, what was happening there? And he goes, no, they're real. We just knew that if we moved in, now that we're in Jesus, they have to move out.
That's incredible, Jonathan. That's really fascinating, because that's what light will do. Now they know the truth. A place that was a no-go area is a place where you can now inhabit, you can live there. But something interesting in what you said is that they actually did not have any reference of God or any placeholder of God. So they had this dark spirits and there's the spirits. In the context of Africa, we know that there was this super being, because our languages do have the super being, but we wouldn't know that that super being is God. It was like someone who created this world, the super being. Any connection to that? I mean, how do you introduce God to this people who have no idea of who God is?
That's actually a part of the story. I don't really know. What I do know is that there was no stumbling block. You know, it seemed to make sense. I learned a lot from my dad over the years, and he never shared with me any challenge around this. So I just assumed that they heard this and it made sense. So the one other aspect of Yali life, the most pervasive aspect of Yali life, of course, it's pervasive for all of us. It's just not in our faces, and that's death. Mm-hmm. But the Yali saw it full face on regularly, whether it was death through war, death through disease, the suicides I mentioned, or natural disasters, things like that. And they were just very, very aware that life is brutal and short. And so here they encounter a good news in which, in having conquered the powers that have a hold on us because of the sin that we have in our own lives, and having dealt with the flesh, when Paul's talking like that, he's really, every time he uses the word flesh, he's talking about that part of being human that isn't being animated by God's spirit. It's just us operating in our animal self, you know, self-will, following just our desires without self-control. That's where sin comes from. So even the flesh has been dealt with on the cross. Mm-hmm. And as a result, because Jesus has been raised from the dead by the power of God, that is brought to us, and we get to have that too. That was transformative for the Yali. Mm. It's like we have been freed from death. They knew it wouldn't happen now. They knew that death still happens, but they knew that there was a promise beyond death, a promise of resurrection, a promise of new life. And one of the interesting things about Yali culture and the way Christianity took expression there is, unlike the West, where our songs are very much about me and Jesus, and sometimes the criticism is it's a kind of a therapeutic Jesus.
Yeah.
The Yali worship exalts Jesus as the greatest over all powers, but then it also longs for the day that he'll return. That is a regular theme in Yali worship, that longing for the day when he'll return, when we know that all the world and all the universe will be brought right.
Yeah, that is fascinating right there, because you also see the difference in the cultures. We know that Western cultures, which I would normally call cold climate cultures, and you have, you know, the more southern cultures that are hot climate cultures, which are much more communal in their approach to life, and the Western cultures are much more individualistic in their approach to life. So just you mentioning the songs of the Yali people, Africa has a lot of that. When we sing, it's much more communal to God. It's much more us to God versus me. That's incredible.
And it's probably closer to the spirit of Scripture, you know. So these are the ways that this text in Colossians really helpfully unpacks the richness of the gospel itself, but also the richness of what the Yali encountered in the gospel. Now, as we've been touching on over the course of our conversation, there are lots of contact points with Africa.
Correct.
Lots of similarities between the Yali people and different tribal and cultural groups in Africa, but particularly around this matter of the ancestor. Mm-hmm. So, Simon, you've lived and grown up here. Let's hear a bit more of your perspective, what you've seen, what you've experienced, and what your thoughts are and observations are.
Yeah, it's actually been amazing to hear this experience of the Yali people being pretty much, you know, in the Asian context and the similarities with the African context. I mean, in the African context, there's always been a reference of there's a super being. You know, that is why our languages have got the names of God, you know. Nkosi, Mudimu, all those names are there because they describe a super being who would, you know, they see the sun shine, they see, you know, the moon and all that. That was for them, there is something there that created all this. But now their reference point towards this big God or super being is through ancestors. That's what they took, obviously, from generation to generation. And now, that what we call ancestral worship today, which actually it is ancestralism, is our way to God through the ancestors. And you have witch doctors or traditional doctors, which in the context of South Africa, they'll be called sangomas. People will consult them in order to get to God. People will go to the graveyards in order to get to God. But when the gospel of Jesus came in, it helped us to understand that Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. We go to God through Christ. But what has been interesting, just looking at the history of Africa, is that a lot of people think now that I can worship God and go through Christ, but I can still go through my ancestors. And we need to just be careful there, what's called syncretism, where people now, when they face certain challenges, is this God enough? Or do I still need to go to my ancestors or to witch doctors? And I encourage people to actually be very clear on what Scripture teaches in terms of our way to God.
That's great. And when I came here in 98, this was one of the things that really stood out to me, is that somebody would go to the Sangoma, and they're a churchgoer, they're a Christian.
Correct.
But they go because the Sangoma will maybe help them deal with a crop issue or a health issue or something like that. And what began to dawn on me is that there was this bifurcation, and that it was almost as if people had in their minds, I can go to Jesus, but that's so that my sins are forgiven and I can go to heaven.
Yeah.
And then I go to my Sangoma to deal with more earthly things. And I think this is where what the Yali experience of the gospel was more faithful to what Scripture is actually teaching. And we talked about this in the last episode, and we've touched on it here, is that what God is doing on the cross is bringing about reconciliation, where all things are put into correct relationship, correct order. And that's human relationships, but it's also spiritual and human. He talks about the powers and the authorities being brought back into right relationship. And I think part of becoming Christian is not simply saying, oh, the spirits don't exist. They do in some form, but saying there's a right place, a right relationship between the spiritual realm and the God that we serve. And that place is not to serve as our mediator.
Yes.
Jesus does that.
Yeah.
And Jesus does that for everything, for our crops, for our health, for our spiritual state, our forgiveness of our sins, and so on. By the way, probably worth mentioning here is, of course, we have listeners who for whom this would be completely alien and strange. And I think it's worth mentioning to our friends who are maybe more from European backgrounds to not impose on our African or Yali brothers and sisters an assumption that they're just being superstitious or these are silly beliefs. Because I can speak from growing up among the Yali, they don't believe these things just because it's the easiest explanation for mysterious things to happen. They believe these things because they actually have experiences of the spiritual realm.
So Jonathan, listening to the story and this conversation we've been having, it's very clear to me that Christianity, it's not a Western religion. It's not a white man's religion as most people have believed. I mean, listening to how God came and connected so well with the Yali people. I'm interested to know, what does the Bible say further about this and your thoughts on this?
Yeah. No, it's definitely not a Western imposition. I mean, how did Christianity even get to the West? You know, it started in the Middle East.
Correct.
And that's been its nature over the years, is that it just transitions from one culture to another. And it has this impulse to cross boundaries. That's in its nature. So no, I think what the Yali experienced was a new life force that entered their lives and their world. It flowed within the culture, reshaping and transforming it. And yet they were still distinctly Yali. In fact, I would say they may not articulate it this way, but I think the average Yali today, or the Christian Yali, would say, we've become who we were meant to be.
Wow.
You know, they would think that way. But what I think is really important at this point is, you know, for listeners, this is very exotic. It's you know, a part of the world that is very different. This story may have been very interesting, but maybe also alien. And I want to bring it back to us, because what we're talking about is this life force that changes us. And I think, especially in the Western world, we tend to talk, even as Christians, we tend to talk about Christianity primarily as an intellectual thing, a set of beliefs. And it is a set of beliefs. But within that, if the beliefs are true, then what's true is that God is at work.
Yep.
And I think that's what we need to focus on, is that it's this life force of God in us. And in order for us to experience it, we have to be rescued. That's the whole theme of today's podcast. Mm-hmm. It's this beginning of reconciliation, of God's reconciling work in all of this universe, in all of creation, is the rescue of human beings. And that's the core of big change, large-scale transformation. And God's power is the power for transformation. It starts within us, his spirit coming within us by his own kindness, by his own grace, as he forgives our sins, and bringing a new life that shapes or reshapes our own personal kind of inward life. It reshapes how we live outwardly, how we live in relationship with others, how we are as a husband or a wife, and how we go about shaping our own culture and being a part of our own culture. And it can be expressed richly in transformed ways of being a husband or a wife, of doing business, of doing the arts, of shaping our culture, like I said, of doing politics. And 2 weeks from now, when you and I meet again, we'll be talking about the political sphere here in South Africa. So this is where big change starts. It starts with God at work in us. It starts with a gift from God of new life. And I want to end with a story of a young woman. This is some years ago when I was in my late 20s. That I met in Papua when I was there with a friend of mine for a visit. And we met this young Swedish woman who was there as a tourist. She is your typical Scandinavian, very liberal in her sort of philosophical views, quite opposed to Christianity. She would have seen it as, she did see it as nonsense. I mean, she said to me, what's this stuff about resurrection? I mean, that's just nonsense.
Wow. You
know? But she was very open as well. And one day she asked us to, you know, just to share a bit more about our faith. And I said, well, how much time do you have? And she said, we have lots of time. We're here in the tribal regions of Papua. And I said, well, I want to tell you the story the way the Yali would tell it. And I'm going to start in the beginning in, you know, the book of Genesis, where God brings all creation into existence, and then he creates humanity, and he gives them this incredible dignity of being made in his image. But then in that story from the Garden of Eden, where they take the fruit and they eat of it, the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, that story is a story about human beings being willful, being God to themselves instead of living in dependence and interdependence with God. And she was fascinated by this story. She'd never heard anything like it. And the following day, she came to me and she said, can you tell me that part again about the garden and the fruits and so on? And so I did. And she said, well, what? Tell me more. What's going on there when you say they're taking the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? They're taking the need to be God to themselves. How does that look? And I said, well, what it looks like is then if I'm being my own master, I'm living a self-willed, selfish life, a selfish life, self-centered life. And she got very contemplative at that point. And she said, yes, I see that. And I actually see how that underpins any evil that you can think of in the world that we live in. And then a couple of days later, she came back to me and we're chatting again. And she said, you know, I've been thinking a lot and I've realized that selfishness is in me as well. Mm. It just informs so much of how I approach life. I'm coming at it from a place of self-control in a negative sense of trying to master my own existence for myself. And it's not a life of ultimately of self-giving. And eventually she left us. She moved on and continued her tour through other parts of Indonesia. And then a month or two later, I got this letter from her. And in this letter, she told me that on her last night among the Yali, she sat on a rock outside the place where we'd been staying, and she wept and she wept and she wept because she realized she had encountered the love of God, and she knew she had to relinquish her need to be her own master and become his follower. But of course, that's a great cost. You're giving up your own self-rule. And so she wept and she wept. And then in her own words, she said, and so that night, Jonathan, I asked Jesus if I could take up my cross and become one of his sheep.
That's incredible. That is incredible. I mean, I guess as someone who's new to the Bible, new to the story of the Bible, new to the gospel, the words that she used is just like so amazing and fresh. And connecting that to even where we started, I mean, when you went for the Jubilee celebration, the Yali people saying that we're celebrating moving from darkness to light. This woman experienced exactly that. So the story of the Yali people impacting people's lives today.
Today, yes. And I think that is probably a great place to end. Just hearing that story of the love of God that pulls us out of where we are, because that's how much he cares for us and rescues us and then sets us up to be a part of big change.
Jonathan, this has been fascinating. I'm looking forward to what God is going to do and the impact it's going to have in many people's lives.
Thanks, Simon. And thank you for joining me. That brings us to the end of this episode. So if you're enjoying this podcast or others at Ziwani, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to come back in a couple of weeks for the next episode, which will be with Simon, Big Change in Africa. And this is about the downfall of apartheid and the healing of a broken nation. So we'll be telling you the incredible but sadly forgotten stories of Christian faithfulness that contributed to South Africa's incredible transition into a free democracy, but also of the challenges that came after that and of what it takes to rebuild a broken nation. So until then, this is goodbye from me, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partnered together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.